This is an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Because of your generous support during our recently concluded spring membership drive, financial planner Kevin McKinley is here to answer your personal finance questions. We are devoting the entire hour to answering your questions. If you have one, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let me welcome our guest. We are very, very fortunate to have with us in studio this time, Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So this is a special thank you edition of On Your Money. We are saying thank you to our wonderful listeners for their wonderful support during our just concluded membership drive. Pretty amazing, huh, Kevin?
Well, we're only thanking the 225 who actually took the time to pledge. Yeah. The rest of you can just piggyback along
really?
With this as well. No, thank you very much for listening and especially for your financial support during our most recent membership drive. You showed up in droves. You received a free copy of the On Your Money Mini Money booklet, On Your Money for Parents and Grandparents. We had 225 people who pledged and raised over $17,000, wildly beat the dollar goal. So in a very small token of our appreciation, we are going to devote the entire show this hour to answering your personal finance questions.
And we do have some callers already lining up and answers ready to go, but you can also submit your question by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, and we'll try to get to as many of your questions as we can. And why don't we start with one from a listener, Kevin, named Linda, who says, I love this program. I really appreciate all of the information that you so generously share.
Ooh, that's a good false praise beginning
right
there. Sets the tone for the rest of the callers and questions. Please include that false praise.
Yeah, that's right. We haven't had that in a while. We haven't had a plea for false praise in a while. My husband, she writes, has been unemployed since 2012. So the only money coming into our household is my income, which is $1,200 per month. That helps cover monthly expenses. We've had to make withdrawals from my husband's retirement account, which results in a penalty and income tax implications. He turned 60 last month. I will be 56 next month. We have whole life insurance policies with $200,000 death benefits each. Each of those policies has an approximate cash surrender value of $35,000. What do you think about cashing in those policies and purchasing two term life insurance policies for the same coverage? Also, if we were to cash those policies in, what would that money be subject to income tax?
Well, thank you, Linda, for your question. And also, thank you for putting so much detail in there, because this is actually a pretty complex situation. There are a lot of moving parts to it. And to back up for a second, first of all, there shouldn't be any more penalties on the husband's IRA withdrawal. Since he's now over 59 and a half, any withdrawals actually from October of last year when he turned 59 and a half will not be subject to the 10% penalty. They will be taxed as income. But from what it sounds like, their income is low enough that they probably won't pay very much, if anything at all, in income taxes. So at least if they need money, they can continue to pull it out of there, and they won't have to pay any penalties or very much, if any, in income taxes.
Do you think they should use the cash value of those life insurance policies?
Yeah, that's a pretty significant dollar amount. If you're kind of, you know, struggling to meet monthly expenses and going through an unemployment period that you're not sure how long it's going to last, and whether they should keep the life insurance policies or not really depends on an unknown, which is how long they're going to live and the amount of money that will be needed if one of them passes away. The longer that they live, the better it will be to actually cash them out now and use the money, because they can use that money to spend it as they see fit, and it will be a very long time before the death benefit would come into play. What they should do, though, is only pull out what they need. So let's say they need an extra $2,000 in a month to subsidize their living expenses, they should only pull $2,000 out in that particular month and then wait to see what happens in the next month and see if they still need to do it, because then their taxation on those dollars will be pretty low. And I definitely agree that Linda is correct. They should try to get a term life insurance policy to replace the lost death benefit from this other policy, because when one of them passes away, eventually, generally, the smaller Social Security check goes away. And what we find is that when you lose a partner, usually your expenses don't go down by as much as the lost Social Security check. So, but even then, if they do just pull a little bit out every single month rather than cashing it in all at once, there still will be some death benefit there until it's exhausted completely.
And what did you say? How bad will the taxes be if they use the cash from their life insurance policies?
Yeah, again, it won't be too bad because, again, their income, their taxable income is so low. You know, there's this notion that something like 45% of Americans don't pay any federal income taxes. They pay other kinds of taxes like property taxes or sales taxes or state income taxes or payroll taxes, but they don't pay any federal income taxes because their income is so low once they add in their deductions and other qualifiers for avoiding taxes. They don't pay any federal income taxes, and it sounds like Linda and her husband are probably in that category, so they probably won't pay very much in federal income taxes on the withdrawals of the policy if they do it in the way that I recommend it.
So if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, you can email it, like Linda did, to onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can call 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can also post it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. So let's take a call now from John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Kevin. I'm 30 years old and considering starting my own business. And the upfront investment that I think I need is maybe around $30,000 to $40,000. And I have a few different options that I think I might have. I have a Roth IRA that I have some money in that I'm considering might be a good option to pull some of that funding out of. I also have quite a bit of equity built up into my home and a line of credit already there that I think could fulfill a lot of that. And I also have a pretty high credit score, and I think 0% interest, kind of introductory rates on new credit cards might also be an option. I'm just wondering if you kind of have any thoughts on that, weighing those three different options, or maybe another option altogether.
Sure, John. And again, it sounds risky, and some people, you know, are listening and cringing right now, even more so than usual while listening to this show. And so they're thinking like, gosh, why, you know, you've done a good job so far. You're very young. Why would you risk this all to start a business? But owning a business is the best way to become financially independent in America. You usually become financially independent because you're broke for so long that you just get old. And by the time it actually achieves any value or constant income, you're not interested in spending it on dumb things anymore. So I definitely recommend you at least give this a shot, and especially since it sounds like you're doing this from a pretty good spot rather than doing it out of desperation. Here's what I do. I look at the credit cards. Those can come back to bite you if you goof up. I would keep the credit score open as long as possible, and then I would also use the Roth IRA, but only use it as a last resort. And when you do it, John, you can use the Roth IRA in this order. You can use all the money that's in there until it equals the amount of contributions, tax-free and penalty-free. So let's say you put $20,000 into that Roth IRA and it's worth $30,000 now. You can pull that $20,000 back out at first with no taxes or no penalties. And so what I'd want you to do is the investment, John, is it something where you have to buy some product, you have to invest in a building or something like that?
It's more kind of money set aside probably for some space renovations, some small early purchases, and also just some runway for my family, just because I probably wouldn't be pulling in the same income I am now, just to make sure we had some flexibility. So some of it would just be kind of savings set aside almost for
emergencies. Yeah,
expenses.
right. No, yeah. that's a good way to look at that. Most small businesses that do go under, they go under because of cash flow issues. Just of what you've said, you're trying to prevent against that, hurting not only the business but your family. So here's what I would do: is I would actually go after. I'd talk to your friendly local lender first and tell them your situation. See what they can do. They might be able to offer some kind of loan to you, especially since it sounds like you're in pretty good shape financially. Banks usually only lend money to people who don't need it, and you don't really need it, and so they're more likely to lend it to you. If you can't get something like for them, then go to those credit cards, but again, only if the interest rate is very low, under, say, 5 or 6%, and be very careful about making sure you make the payments, that you don't run afoul of them, because the interest rates can go up very quickly. The average rate on credit cards is about 15 or 16%, and they can go much higher if you're not in good financial shape. Then after that, look at tapping your home equity line of credit. And finally, use that Roth IRA only to help make the payments on those other debt, the borrowing, because then that keeps you current for another 30 days, hopefully while you're getting the business started and getting it going. And it helps you from going into default if you miss a payment.
Okay, great. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, good luck, John.
Yeah, good luck, John. I'm very impressed. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question, a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley. Mary in Wauwatosa is with us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I've got a question on the U.S. savings bonds, and I don't intend to cash them, but they're from 1995 on forward. And do I have to pay income tax on some pretend interest, which I don't get until I actually sell the bond?
Pretend interest.
Yeah, well, actually, it's funny you bring that up because it's or use that phrase, because you're right, Mary. It's interest that you technically have been credited with, but nobody sent you a check for it, right?
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting with savings bonds. You get a choice of how you want to declare the interest and pay taxes on it. You can either do it every year, or you can do it when you actually cash the bonds in or they mature. And you get to kind of choose a method, but you have to stick with it, and you have to use the same method for all of your savings bonds. So those are 30-year savings bonds. So if you took them out in 1995, I have to do the math here, so we're looking at about 22 years you've had those. Right, you can, as long as you don't tap into them, you can actually keep deferring the taxation on until the 30 years are up. They'll mature, they'll stop using interest, and then that's the time that you'll declare the interest on your tax form and then pay taxes on it.
All right, Mary, thanks for the call. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. We are devoting the entire hour to answering your personal finance questions. It's a thank you for your generous support during our recently concluded membership drive. So do you have a question about planning for retirement or buying a home or saving for college? Whatever the case may be, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Our number, if you have a question for Kevin, is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. So let's go back to the phones. Raul in Madison is with us now. Hi, Raul.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a two-part question regarding beneficiaries of IRAs or 401ks. First part with regard to spouses. The second part with regard, if there is not a surviving spouse, to children who are beneficiaries. May they take those assets into their own IRAs? And if so, what are the tax consequences associated with that?
Generally, if it's a spousal inheritance, then it goes to the spouse's IRA, and there are no tax consequences to it as long as they leave it, if it goes from one IRA to another without taking an actual distribution. And then the child can get what's known as an inherited IRA, and then usually they have to make withdrawals on it based on their life expectancy at a minimum. They could take it all out if they want, but whatever they take out, it will be taxable as ordinary income to that beneficiary.
So in that situation, the tax would be deferred for the children.
Yeah, as long as the money stays in there. Now, when they have to start taking money out of it, then it is taxed as income, depending on the children's situation. Though, again, oftentimes they have no income or their income is low enough where they don't pay any taxes on it at all.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Raul. We go now to Christy in Grafton, who has probably my favorite question ever. Hi, Christy.
Hello. My question is, as I explained to the guy, I have retired May 31st of last year, and I have done my bit for saving. I worked at the post office. I have a thrift savings plan. I also have a Roth. So in my thrift, there's like $700,000. In the Roth, there's $300,000 or $400,000. My question is I don't know how to now turn around and spend it. It's like mentally saving was easy.
Oh.
Doing the opposite isn't. And I don't know how, I don't know who I need to talk to try and find out how to do this the best way financially for me.
I think a bunch of people right now are listening, Christy, going, call me up. I'll help you spend that money.
That is, I mean, I was thinking, what a fun question. But yeah, you're right. You want to spend it, but it sounds like you're afraid you don't want to spend too much of it and run out, Christy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right now I'm living on the annuity that the post office gives me, along with the Social Security supplemental that they also provide, because I will be 61 in September.
Okay. And not to joke about it, Christy, because you sound like a lot of the mm-hmm. clients I work with in my grown-up job, and most of them are wealthier than they thought they would be when they turned 59 or 65 or whatever. And it really is challenging to completely switch your mentality from this save, don't spend, to, okay, now you probably have more money than you have time to live. How do you go about spending this money? It's kind of like saying, oh, you're in good shape, you eat well, you exercise, you've been fortunate in your health, but it's okay now to start eating half a dozen donuts, a pound of bacon, and smoking a couple menthol cigarettes for breakfast.
Flip that switch.
It's flip that switch. It's just something that we're taught to do, and good for you that you're fortunate enough that you had the resources to do it and you had the discipline. But it takes about a year, Christy, I've found, for people to kind of transition from this working and earning and saving to retiring and spending and to feel comfortable doing it. One of the best ways I can recommend is the way that you're already doing it, which is to spend, you know, your annuity or your pension check every single month, but then figure out what else you need. If that covers your needs, awesome. Don't spend anything, you know, save it for later, give it, donate it to charities. But it's a good way to say, I'm just going to spend my Social Security or my pension check, or I'm going to figure out what's a sustainable amount from my assets that I can spend every single month. And I'm going to have that sent from my big account, like my IRA or my 401k, directly to my checking account every month. So it kind of psychologically and philosophically replaces the paycheck that I've lost, so that I know that if I spend $3,000 that I'm getting from my IRA this month, I know there's another $3,000 coming on the same day next month that I can use to cover other expenses.
Okay, but I guess the other part of the question is, the understanding I have from my thrift is that I can't just take out when I need it. Like, I thought about, okay, if I want to go on a really big vacation that would cost, you know, a chunk of money.
Right.
They won't let me. I have to actually designate an amount that comes out every month, or as opposed to a chunk here and a chunk 6 months from now and a chunk, you know what I mean?
To taking it as you need it, you have
right.
to do it. And that's okay. And if that's the only, that's your big chunk of money, I would start doing that now so that when these other things come up, you can use that second account to pull the money from. Say if it's $3,000 a month, after 3 months, you'd have $9,000 in there.
Oh, I see. So you're saying have an amount taken out and
right.
then just kind of set it to the side
exactly.
For the things that I want to do that are going to require more money.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. Well, Christy, good luck. Have fun. I always, I often tease my husband, Rob, on this show, Kevin, because he's the saver and I'm the spender. And,
right.
And I just told him about this African safari that I found online that I want to go on. And it is ridiculously expensive. It's like $11,000 per person. He said, oh my God, after he had a heart attack. That's together, right?
Right. He said, no, sorry. It's funny you bring that up as an aside. Most couples, especially successful couples, and by successful, I mean people who are still together and can kind of talk about things and work it out rather than fighting about it and splitting up, there usually is a spender and a saver. And there's one who's confident and maybe too confident sometimes, and there's one who usually worries maybe too much and says, gee, you know, we spend $3,000 a month and I don't think $3 million is going to be enough to retire on. And I used to think it was gender specific, but it's not. There are several couples I've worked with where there's a woman who says, hey, we're going to be fine. And the guy says, geez, I don't know. I'd just as soon not spend that. Now I found I've worked with several couples of the same gender. And yeah. There still is a spender and a saver in it. So it doesn't have anything to do with gender. It just probably has to do with the way you're wired.
Right. And I brought this up because it is, as he's retired, I'm not yet, but it is this.
That's part of it, too.
Will we have enough money to go?
You've got a paycheck coming in, right. He doesn't.
Well, let's see. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. We are devoting the entire hour to answering your personal finance questions. To thank you for your support during our recently concluded membership drive, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, our next question is from a listener named Dan, who says, I am a longtime listener, first-time questioner, and would like to follow your advice and split my retirement between 50% in S&P index funds and 50% in CDs. Right now, instead of CDs, I have 50% in bonds. Vanguard has only CD funds, not real CDs. This is 401k money, so I don't want to take it out and put it in real CDs. What do you think? I'm confused. There are not real CDs.
They're fake CDs. They're just, it makes you feel good until you try to cash them in, then they're not really there. Well, and to be fair, it's not my advice to Dan specifically to invest his money that way. I have no idea what his situation is, his tolerance for risk is, how much he needs it. It's just a way to kind of use a simple kind of no-brainer investment strategy for people who say, I don't need this money right now. I can accept some risk, but I do need some growth. And it's by splitting it up between hopefully complementary investments like CDs that don't make very much but aren't going to lose a lot, and then another portion into lower-cost index funds, which are going to have a much higher risk-reward proposition. And the key is to actually rebalance those accounts maybe once per year so that if one exceeds the other in size, you can prune some of it off and put it into the other one, and hopefully you'll have a smoother ride. But more importantly, it's a strategy that helps you stay disciplined so that you're not buying high. You're not saying, gosh, I've made so much money in the stock fund, I'm going to put it all there, and then it goes down. Nor does it keeps you from panicking at the bottom and saying, I'm going to take it all out of the stock funds and put it into the CDs.
All right, so what if you can't buy CDs in a retirement account like 401k?
Well, you usually can't. Most 401ks, 403bs do not have actual CDs that you can buy in there. Some of them have a brokerage window in the account where you can buy certificates of deposit through a place like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity, whichever company serves the 401k or the 403b. So first of all, if you can't get CDs through that option in your retirement plan account, look at using any outside money for those CDs, like your checking account, savings account, what have you. And then if you make Roth IRA contributions, you can put those into CDs directly at a bank or credit union as well. And over time, hopefully you can build up enough there to get the balance a little closer to even to what you have in your 401k or your 403b.
And what if an investor's only assets are in a 401k or a 403b?
Well, you should do what you can. Most of those kinds of plans usually have a money market account. They might have a stable value fund or a guaranteed income fund, or even short-term bond funds that you can use as well. Now, those are not the same thing as CDs. They generally either don't pay as much as CDs, or they're not as safe in the sense that they're not FDIC insured and they don't have a guaranteed maturity date in which you know you'll get your principal back. CDs are the best. They can be safer than these bond funds and give you more yield than money market. But the key here really is to rebalancing between those complementary assets. So if you only can use a money market account or a stable value fund or even a short-term bond fund, just make sure that you're splitting it appropriately and then rebalancing it, even if it seems like one has gone better to the other. And it's kind of like, you know, I have three children. And it's kind of like saying to the, when you rebalance, you're kind of saying to the kid who has straight A's, you go to your room. And the other one who has C's, D's, and F's saying, come on, we're going out for ice cream. Because you're pulling money away from the thing that's done well and putting it into the thing that hasn't done as well.
Well, speaking of CDs, Tony in Verona is with us. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I do have a question to kind of follow on to the CDs. Right now I have money. It's more than $25,000. That I want to put into a CD. I've got my money invested in the stock market fairly heavily, other monies, okay? I'm not going to use this for another, I'd say 5 years or more. So I'm looking possibly at a five-year rate CD, but I'm thinking, you know, with the Fed considering raising the rates, should I wait for a month or two? And, you know, in June they'll probably raise rates, and won't that drive CD rates up?
Right, you can wait, Tony. We don't know for sure that the Federal Reserve actually will raise interest rates, and even if the Federal Reserve does raise interest rates, we don't know that it will translate to higher certificate of deposit rates. And so I understand why you would want to wait to see if you can get a higher rate, but sometimes, you know, the Federal Reserve can change their mind. There are lots of motivations for them to not raise interest rates, especially right now, and so they may not follow through with it, and so many people know about it, they might have already priced it into bond investments so that the rates are still as high as they're going to be, even if the increase goes through. And if you buy right on your CDs, Tony, you'll hopefully get one that has little or no penalty for early withdrawal, so that if, let's say, you take out a five-year CD today and it pays 2%, and a year from now rates have gone to 3% on similar CDs, you can hopefully pull that CD out, put it someplace else, excuse me, and then get a better rate on it once the new rates have gone up, if indeed that does happen.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. 1-800-642-1234, or send your personal finance question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Laura in Shorewood is with us. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm wondering what the smartest way to pay down my debt is right now. My husband just graduated from college. It was his second career. So he just graduated with an engineering degree, and I'm a nurse. I've been working for about 10 years. And we own a duplex, and now we have quite a bit of debt from his college, both on credit cards and, you know, for his student loans. And I'm just wondering what the smartest way to begin paying down our debt is now. I'm considering, you know, seeking out a financial advisor or finding some good books. Maybe you could recommend one that I could read to help us with paying this debt down now that we will have doubled our income. We also own a duplex, and we are making, you know, about $400 to $500 a month on rent from our duplex, but I know the market is improving, and I'm toying with the idea of selling the duplex to more quickly pay down our debt.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Laura, do you live in the one side of the duplex, or is it just an investment property?
We used to live in one side, but now we are renting both sides.
Okay. One of the things that you'll probably find, do you like the other parts about, I mean, I shouldn't say like is too strong a word. Can you tolerate the other parts of being a landlord and a property owner?
Yes, I think we can. We've been doing well at that.
Okay. One of the funny things that happens a lot is people come to me and say, hey, I own duplexes or eightplexes or student rentals or whatever. I got tired of it. I sold it and I've got X million dollars. Here's the check. You invested for me. And then I say, okay, well, you know, do you want to keep it safe? Do you want growth? No, I just want a really nice income. So let's keep it pretty secure. And then I say, well, that'll get you about a 2 or 3% yield. They say, I was getting 10% or 11% on this money from the properties, and the properties were going up in value to go along with it. So I would say, if you're comfortable with it, I would say not to sell the duplex, because over time, I think you will make more money on that if you're comfortable being a property manager and owner, then mm-hmm. you will save by paying off the debt. Now, if you say, we don't like it anymore and I don't like the debt, sure, I could see that. But otherwise, I'd rather have you hang on to the duplex for it. The credit cards are probably the first place I would start. Do you know more about what, on average, the interest rate is of those cards?
It's pretty high. It's okay. Probably like 18 to 20.
Okay, yeah, that's fairly normal. It is high, but it's normal for credit cards. So that's where I'd start first, is I would pay those off. Just make the minimum payments on everything else and then pay the credit cards off as quickly as you possibly can, and maybe even talk with the lender and see if it's possible to borrow against some equity at lower interest rates, mm-hmm. so that you can save the money on the interest of the credit cards. Then after that, I would go towards the student loans and pay off the private ones first. Keep, if you have any federal loans, subsidized or unsubsidized, only make the minimum payments on those, and then after you've made the payments on the credit cards, paid those off, paid off any private student loans, then and only then should you start retiring the principal on the student loans, on the other subsidized student loans.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Laura. Thanks for the call. Clark in West Bend is with us now. Hi, Clark.
Good morning. Well, Kevin, I used your advice. I took the money that I was having in the bank and having them invest it, and I went to a certified financial advisor. They do charge a slightly higher rate for that service, however. And I'm thinking about taking about 10% out and put it into a index fund, although the financial advisor has me in a balanced fund with some bonds in it. The index fund, of course, would be pure stocks. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking that there is one index fund I can put $15,000 in with no interest on it. What's your thought about that?
I'm sorry, no interest? I don't understand what that means.
Or, no, I'm sorry, no service fee.
Oh, no cost to it. Sure.
Right.
Well, yeah, if you're comfortable investing on your own and searching things out and monitoring it, managing it, sure, that's a good idea. It's kind of like mowing your lawn. If you like mowing your lawn, you can do it yourself. And if you don't like doing it or you don't want to, pay someone else to do it. And it's just a question of, you think you're getting value for what you're actually spending with the financial advisor. And that value doesn't often come, or doesn't always come, I should say, in the form of saying, well, I made more money with this financial advisor than I would have on my own. We'll never know if that's the case. It's just to say, is it worth it to pay this person to do something that I either don't know how to do or I don't want to do? And so, yeah, one of two things will probably happen, Clark, if you put the money in the index fund. Either you say, gee, I can do this myself. I'm going to continue to do everything on my own and not have to pay somebody to do it. Or you'll say, gee, this is harder than I thought. And so, therefore, I am going to pay somebody else, and I'm much happier paying it to them. And then they get to lay awake at night and worry about it, and I can sleep better.
Well, it's just that the $15,000 has no penalty, no charges whatsoever, whereas I am paying a couple $100 a month for this service.
Right. And it's just a question of whether you think it's worth that $200 or not. Some people would and others wouldn't.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much, Clark. And Clark said, I followed your advice. So you're not telling everybody that they should go to a financial planner, are you,
no,
Kevin?
No, not at all. No, yeah. We try to make that clear. We should just have a constant, like, while we're talking, have in the background the disclaimer constantly playing on a loop or something. So you can hear it say that, you know, we're just trying to give as much advice as we can, but your specific situation may not apply to the advice that we're giving and vice versa.
Right. All right. If you have a question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, you can call right now at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can even post a question if you want on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. Because of your generous support during our recently concluded membership drive, we are devoting the entire hour to answering your personal finance questions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Money, 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 money. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. We are answering all your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And when I say we are answering all your personal finance questions, I mean Kevin is. Here's an email from a listener named Carrie who says, I'm 62 with $200,000 in a savings account that I received as an inheritance. My financial representative recommends that I funnel the annual max into my employer deferred compensation program, which is a 457B with about $18,000 annually for the next 4 years. He also wants to put $100,000 into an annuity. Lastly, I was interested in applying $10,000 toward the principal of my mortgage and having my payment re-amortized. I refinanced 7 years ago into a 30-year loan at 4.5% interest with a $100,000 balance. So, Kevin, what are your thoughts on annuities and reducing my mortgage?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't listening.
It was a long one.
What was the question? Yeah, Carrie, let's start with the good part about your question. I like the deferred comp contributions because there's an immediate tax savings on that for most people who are in the 15% federal income tax bracket. You know, if you put $10,000 extra into your deferred comp, you get an immediate savings of $1,500 on your federal income tax bill. Now, you will pay taxes on that eventually when you pull it out, but most of the time people are in a lower income tax bracket in retirement than they were when they were working. So that's good. And credit to the advisor, because many times we hear about advisors saying, no, don't put your money in your at-work plan. Give it to me instead. And that not only costs you money in the form of higher taxes, but it usually means you pay higher fees or commissions to the advisor. So I would check to see if not only are you maxing out that 457, but if there are other options like a 403B, or do you qualify to make a tax-deductible IRA contribution or a Roth IRA, or can you make a spousal IRA or Roth IRA contribution as well, because you could put even more than just that $18,000 in there.
But what about this recommendation to put $100,000 into an annuity?
Well, both are regular listeners to the show, Joy, know that I'm generally not a big fan of annuities, especially for new money. And when the world is her oyster for where she can put that, why would she choose into an annuity? Well, often it's because there are high commissions and fees that are paid to the advisor and to the company. And then Carrie, instead, will get big surrender charges if she tries to pull that money out within the first, usually 6 to 15 years. Now, the nice thing about a tax-deferred variable annuity, which it sounds like is what he's recommending, the gains are sheltered. But eventually, when you do pull that money out, any gains are going to be taxed as ordinary income at the highest rate. And the bad news about annuities versus just using a regular index fund or something is if you do have any losses in it, it's very difficult to use those losses to help offset your taxes and offset your capital gains. So I'm not as much of a fan as using that annuity.
How about using some of the money to pay down the mortgage?
Yeah, sure. I think that can be a good idea for a portion of it. You know, it can help reduce her payment and her interest cost. But she should also look at refinancing because she may get a lower interest rate. She might get a higher valuation on her property from what she received the last time she re-amortized the mortgage. Usually you need to save about 0.5% in interest to make it worth the cost and the hassle of refinancing, meaning she'd have to go from 4.5% to 4%. And you probably shouldn't plan on paying more than a few thousand dollars in overall closing costs to still make it worthwhile.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He is here just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. And today is a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money, devoting the entire hour to your calls and your questions and your emails. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Chris in Bristol is with us now. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Morning. Yes, go ahead. What's your question?
All right, so my partner and I are 25 years old, and why I called in is because, like 10 minutes ago, you mentioned how you see how there's always a spender and a saver, even
yep.
in same-sex couples. It's so true, it's beyond me. But Joe and I are both 25, and we live in an apartment. I have about $20,000 of student loan debt that were federal loans for my bachelor's. He recently just paid all of his off. His income is a third greater than mine, so I make two-thirds of what he makes. And we're wanting to buy a house.
And he never lets you forget that either, does he, Chris?
No, like on a regular basis. And it's the way it is. He's a really hard worker, and that's what's great about it.
Cool.
But I also put 15% of my income into my employer-sponsored 401k because I look at it as why would I pass up free money?
Absolutely.
So the short of it is he doesn't, you know, it's like when he gets his paycheck, he just spends it. But if he always has money in his checking account, then he feels like he's good, but we're trying to save for the future. So mm-hmm. what I guess I'm asking you is, what resources can I give to him or help him out with? And, like, understanding that you have to like, save on your own, and like, where would you direct us?
Mm-hmm. That's kind of, Chris, it's a great question. And I'll tell you, again, most of the people I work with have been together for 30 or 40 years as a couple, and they are still struggling with that same issue you are. So I hope you have a long and happy relationship. I can't guarantee that it's something that will change. It's more that you kind of bend and accept towards each other, and then you move forward. It's kind of like looking at a car. One person would say, why on earth would you ever have a brake pedal in this car? You want to go forward. You want to go. And the other person says, my gosh, that gas pedal is dangerous. You're going to push that so far that we're going to go too fast, and we're not going to be able to stop, and we're going to crash. I would say a good way to help mitigate what you might consider to be overspending is to say, hey, put aside X percent of your money into your employer's retirement plan, just like you're doing, Chris, and then you can spend whatever's left over. So if is it Joe that you said?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, all right. But he doesn't have an employee-sponsored retirement plan.
But he does work, right? He has earned income?
Yeah.
Okay, then he can open up an IRA, and he can put in up to $5,500 per year on that, which is a great amount to start saving at your very young age. That's over $425 a month. You can say, look, as long as you're putting $425 per month into your IRA every single month, then I will be okay with whatever you spend, as long as it's cash and as long as you're not adding to our credit card debt or any other debt that we take on.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Judy in Racine is with us now. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks, Kevin, for all your good advice. Can you please tell me, and I'm sure you can, how much of an EdVest contribution is tax deductible?
The EdVest contributions, Judy, thank you for your false praise. The EdVest contributions are tax deductible at the state level, and it's about $3,100 per beneficiary per year. So how that works is if you put in any amount up to $3,100, then you can reduce your state taxable income for Wisconsin residents by that amount. And so that ends up saving you. It's not significant because the state tax rates are relatively low compared to the federal taxes, but most people probably save maybe $100 on their state income taxes if they put in that much money, and then you can carry it forward. So if you put more money into it, you can use that deduction in future years as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Judy. Dick in Cumberland is with us now. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Joy and Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I'm going to be turning 70 in a couple of years, and I've got a comfortable amount of money that I'll have to be taking out of various accounts, et cetera. How do I plan for that? And a couple years in advance, I mean, I have enough income to live on right now, plenty as a matter of fact, and I'll be having more. I'm just not sure how to prepare for that, and what should I be doing with that extra income? Should I spend it? Should I save it? Should I gift it? What should I do?
Yes.
Yeah, all of those
all
things.
All of those things, Dick. Good for you. Dick, do you have an idea as to how you sit right now in terms of where your what your federal income tax bracket is?
Not offhand.
Okay. What I'd like to see you do in advance of this is figure out where you're at and figure out how much you could take from those retirement accounts and convert them to Roth IRAs and still remain in the 15% federal tax bracket. That number is determined by what's on line 43 of your 1040. And in terms of gross income for married filers, it's filing jointly, it's usually about $100,000 of gross income and about half that for single filers, but you know, your situation's different depending on the amount of deductions you have. So I try to convert that amount over to Roth IRAs and still remain in the 15% bracket, because that means that'll reduce the amount that you have to take for your required minimum distributions. assuming the laws hold as they are, and that's in this day and age, that's not a safe assumption. You will have an option, Dick, where you can, you know, donate some of that money or all of it from your required minimum distribution when you're 70 and a half and not have to itemize. But if it goes to a qualified charity, you still it goes over tax-free. It doesn't affect the taxation of the rest of it.
Like public radio?
Yeah, that
boy, you know, I didn't think
that's
of that.
That's an idea.
Jeez, I guess you, theoretically yes. You could give it to public radio. Yeah, you're exactly right. Any qualified nonprofit can receive that money, and that's a way to avoid the taxation on it, even if you don't itemize, so that you can get the charitable deduction. And there's talk that the charitable deduction may go away. And so if it does, this would be interesting to see how that affects that for the time being. But no, I'd encourage you, if you have any anything that you are hesitant to spend money on, Dick, you sound like you're in good health. I think you're going to live a very long time, and I hope you do, but you're in that great situation where you probably have more money than you have time. So if it's anything, a trip especially, that you think you'd like to take while you physically can do so, please do it. And that's what you should do with that money.
Yeah, I just had one in the springtime, and I went as a solo on a cruise for 2 weeks, and they want to go again, so I'm thinking Panama Canal or New Zealand or someplace. And even an earlier caller had said to an African
safari.
That was me.
Safari. That was some crank.
You want to go, Dick?
Yes, please.
Yeah, Dick, please. Please
very
travel.
Compatible. And I snore just a little bit.
Dick, have fun. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Marcia and Racine. Hi, Marcia.
Good morning. I'm in a dilemma. I'm hoping you can help me out. I have a CD coming due. Actually, it's an inheritance in January of 18, and I want to do one of three things with it, and I'm looking for your advice. I'm in a income bracket where I'm under $20,000 a year that I make. So I'm, you know, could use some helping with that. The three situations I'm looking at is I would like to go back to school with that money, or I would like to take half the money, pay ahead on my bills, and have part of it go to my schooling. Otherwise, I'd like to take all of it and just pay ahead on all my bills and have that security, or as well as, you know, search for a different job or added income.
Right.
What's
yeah.
your thought?
Good for you, Marcia. I think there's a couple different questions here. I think you should decide, first of all, are you going to go back to school? And that's the big one. And if you do go back to school, I would actually keep that money aside so that you can maintain your monthly expenses and see what kind of financial aid you can get from the school before you do it. And then hopefully if you have the money still left over when you're done and you get your degree, then you can use it to pay off the student loans. But that's your first question. Then after that, I'd say I'd like you to keep at least 3 months worth of living expenses set aside before you prepay any bills or pay off any other bills, so that if there is an emergency, you do lose your job, you've got some cushion in there to cover your expenses. You don't have to take just the next job that's available. You can look around for a little bit and find one that works better for you.
Good luck, Marcia. Almost out of time, and hoping we can do a real quick one with Sherry in Eau Claire. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to tell Kevin we used to read your articles in our local paper and enjoyed them.
You were the one.
my question is, we're in the market for a new vehicle. We keep our vehicles a long time. We have a 97 with 238,000 on it, so we keep them until they die.
We have less than a minute, Sherry, so you want to know?
Okay. Lease or buy? And if we buy, do we pay cash or take out a loan?
Ooh. You sound like if you have the option of paying cash, you're probably in good financial shape. Therefore, I would take out the loan, the very low interest loan. It should be less than 3% if it's not just pay cash. But otherwise, no. If you keep them a long time, Sherry, you want to actually own the car, not lease it.
There we go. Good luck, Sherry. So what's the website of the week?
Well, it's another long one, but at Zillow.com, they have a mortgage calculator that tells you if you should look at refinancing it. You add in the value, the amount that you owe, the interest rate, then what the new loan would be, and they'll tell you whether or not you should refinance your mortgage. Zillow.com, but we'll have a link to the direct link at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less.
Have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.